Hi guys, and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. I'm Joel.
I'm Billy Ray.
And we are finally at the end of Season 6. We will be discussing Season 6, Episode 23, I Guess This Is Goodbye.
Yeah, what a wild ride. What a wild last few episodes leading up to this finale.
It really has. It really feels like they've gone all out for the last few episodes, probably because they knew full well that middle of the season, they just kind of seem to lose care.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, when you've got this many episodes to fill, you're going to get some fill-ins, some filler.
You'll get some duds, yeah. So I will be doing the overview of this final episode and B will be giving us the trivia. So I think we're all excited to hear what the trivia is for the last episode.
Shall I begin?
No. Yeah, of course.
Thank you, judges. So this episode was written by Alexandra Cunningham and directed by David Grossman, and it first aired on the 16th of May 2010. On this day, the number one song in the US was OMG by Usher featuring Will.i.am, and the number one song in the UK was Good Times by Roll Deep.
Still?
Yep. On Monday the 10th of May, Flavor Flav guest hosted the wrestling show WWE Raw.
Okay.
Which is a very strange sentence.
What, WWE Raw?
Flavor Flav.
Oh, well, yeah, it's Flavor Flav.
On Tuesday the 11th of May, David Cameron became the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom after forming a coalition government between Liberal Democrats and his own Conservative Party, which I personally think is cheating.
Yes.
On Wednesday the 12th of May, an Afriquie Airways flight crashed and killed everyone but one person on board, which is absolutely tragic, but like that one person, like, wow.
Trauma? Oh my god. Survivor's guilt.
I know. On Thursday the 13th of May, the Rock for the Rainforest benefit concert was held at Carnegie Hall in New York City, with performers including Sting, Elton John, Bruce Springsteen, Mary J. Blige, Debbie Harry, Lady Gaga, Shirley Bassey, Nile Rodgers, and Shirley Bassey. Have I not already said Shirley Bassey?
You have already said Shirley Bassey. She was so good, they put her twice.
On Friday the 14th of May, the 51,700-seat Aviva Stadium was officially opened on the site of the famous old Lansdowne Road Stadium in Dublin by Irish Prime Minister Brian Cowan.
Okay.
On Saturday the 15th of May, the English FA Cup final was held at the Wembley Stadium in London, where Chelsea beat Portsmouth 1-0, for all you sports fans. Also, Jessica Watson, at age 16, became the youngest person to sail solo, non-stop, and unassisted around the world. At 16.
Yeah.
I've done nothing for the first time, and I'm a lot older than 16. And actress and model Danielle Harris got married to actor Jensen Ackles at the Rosewood Crescent Court Hotel in Dallas, Texas, which is far less interesting than the previous one.
I don't know any of those people.
Jensen Ackles was an actor in Supernatural.
Oh, okay, fair.
On Sunday the 16th of May, and this is the final on this week thing, British comedian David Walliams married supermodel Lara Stone at the Claridge's Hotel in London. And Lara Stone is the most British name I've ever heard, even more than Lara Croft.
Oh, okay, yeah.
This episode was watched by 12.747 million viewers in its original broadcast. Will you calm down?
That was timing. That like punctuated the end of your sentence.
Tanner Stransky of EW.com was very positive regarding this episode, saying, and I quote, "After a season that was undoubtedly rocky, a rollercoaster ride for a mix of good and bad storylines, the minds behind Desperate Housewives managed to put together a season finale that was rather action-packed and full of drama. Now, my fellow Desperate TV watchers, that's a season finale." End quote.
Okay.
She's probably not English, but that's how I read it.
Yeah.
This episode marks Paul's first appearance since Season 3, Episode 13, and Zane Hewitt's first appearance since Season 4's The Gun Song.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we do see a very brief shot of Zane Hewitt in this.
I don't actually know who that is.
He's young Porter.
Oh, okay.
No, Parker. Young Parker.
The only season finale to not feature Carlos as well this episode.
Yeah, because he's away on a business trip, isn't he? Yeah. So it doesn't feature Carlos at all.
The only one, apparently.
Yeah, that's sad. I wonder what he was doing.
There's a little bit more, and then I'm done. In this episode, Catherine Houston, who plays Karen McCluskey, is apparently promoted to a starring cast member as her name leaves the also-starring credit group being billed after James Denton, who plays Mike Delfino.
Damn straight. She's been in this show from the beginning.
And now she's getting her dues.
Right.
The title of this episode comes from a song of the same name in the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, and this is the best one, Lynette is held hostage for the third time.
Yeah.
In show history.
How unlucky do you have to be? There are people in the world right now that have never been held hostage and never will get held hostage, and you get held hostage three times.
Yeah, these ladies, these desperate ladies have the worst luck.
They really do. Okay, so previously on Desperate Housewives, due to the massive debt that they have racked up, Susan and Mike have to move out of the lane. An attempt to pay off Sam only pissed him off more, and he's now demanding full control of Bree's company, otherwise he'll threaten to tell the police and the Solisas about Andrew running over Juanita Sr. Gabby has found a note from Angie telling her that her and Danny are being held hostage and she has to get Nick, and Lynette has found out about Eddie murdering his mother, and now she is trapped alone with him.
Rough.
Yeah. So let's get started. So, we'll start with Bree. Bree is clearly going through something as she's doing her I'm working through my emotions by baking routine, and she seems to be like stress baking. Andrew and Orson come in to hear what they hope is good news regarding Bree kicking Sam to the curb, but she tells them that he is now blackmailing her with info on Mrs. Solis, which confuses Orson as he doesn't really get what Gabby has to do with this, which means that Bree actually never told him about the whole Andrew killing a woman thing.
Yeah, that is something that she completely left as a secret. That's not... Secrets aren't good for a marriage, Brie.
No, they're not good for a marriage, but also we've seen what Orson has been like previously, so maybe it was a good thing that Brie never told him, because he would have used that against her.
Yeah, maybe, but if you're in a relationship where you're worried about someone using your past against you, maybe you shouldn't be with them.
So Brie tells Andrew and Orson that she will be bending over to Sam's demands and giving him her company so he doesn't go to the police. Then Andrew tells Brie not to bother because it's about time he faced up to what he did. But Brie won't have it. Orson tries to chime in, but Brie shuts him down.
I thought that was really sweet of Andrew, by the way. Very grown up.
It was. Andrew's really definitely matured over the years.
Dude's come a long way. Even if he is still doing some really shady stuff.
He is, but he's gay. We do that.
Well, I've never embezzled customers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that is a bit too far, I think. Bree is signing over her entire company to Sam with the condition that if he tells anyone about Andrew and Juanita Sr., then he will be forced to pay Bree all sorts of money. In which are Bree's words, those were her words in the scene, which basically means the writers didn't really want to have to figure out some.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Sam goes to leave and apologises to Bree, saying he didn't want it to end this way, and he gets it if she needs to hate him. But Bree drops some harsh truths on Sam's ass, telling him that nobody will ever care about him, and then she says, "Will you please be a dear and close the door on the way out of my life?"
Yeah, so that was quite a terrible ending for Bree, really, but you know what? She got a really good burning at the end.
She got a fantastic final line with Sam. Mm. Like, I would let all of my life go to shit if I knew that I'd be given a line like that.
When she said, "I don't think anyone's ever gonna really care about you."
Yeah.
Oh, that's got a sting.
I like the removal and the constant removal and putting on of the glasses that Bree does. Like, she puts on the glasses as Sam goes to leave. She's about to read a document. And then Sam turns around and stops. And so she takes the glasses off to talk to Sam. And then she puts them back on after she's like, "Will you please be a dear and close the door on the way out of my life?"
It's like the opposite of reading glasses from Drag Race.
Yeah,
like,
it
the,
is.
The
yeah,
library's she, open, but I'm taking the glasses off.
She takes those glasses off to read.
Yeah. Now, yeah, it's quite a sad ending for Bree. She's got to give away her entire company that she's built up, but in a way, it could be a cool, soft reboot of Bree. We could actually see her build something from the ground up this time with our own eyes.
Mm.
You know, not just have it happen in a 5-year time jump that we miss.
Yes. I mean, you're
we can see that.
You're talking about how it's a sad ending for Bree, and we've not even got halfway through her story yet. Or we are about halfway through.
A sad ending for Bree's company.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Bree tells Orson that it's all done and it's Sam's company now, and Orson seems surprised that Bree was actually able to do it. But Bree didn't think she had any other choice, as she can always start a new company, but she can't send her son to jail. And this is where Orson points out Bree's hypocrisy, as she sent him to jail in order to earn her forgiveness, and then Bree believes it was a different situation, but it kind of wasn't, really.
Not really. I mean, she uses the defense of, "Well, he is my son," but really, that's not all that far departed from the situation, is it?
No, but I mean, I'll finish it and then we can go in further in depth about it. Yeah, so Bree claims that Andrew was a child at the time, but Orson thinks that as he isn't anymore, he should face up to what he did. And so then Bree tells Orson that she was wrong. She admits that she took it too far with Orson, and she shouldn't have asked him to go to jail. But Orson doesn't want an apology, as he respected her for demanding better of him. Orson was treating this as a test, essentially, to see if Bree would behave in the same way. And as she hasn't, in Orson's opinion, she has failed, and so he's now leaving her.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the final sort of little scene that Bree has with Andrew, Bree is sort of standing alone in Orson's empty room, so it really didn't take him too long to pack. And she tells Andrew that Orson left her because she's a hypocrite, and Andrew asks if there's anything that he can do. And Bree asks for his permission to do something that she should have done a long time ago. And then that's essentially the end of Bree's story, because the final scene I've put in Susan's.
Now, I've got a couple of things. The first one is that because Bree is in quite a privileged position, she's kind of right when she says, in a way, like, I can just start a new business or whatever. She's in a great way. She's like, I can sign this over. I can start something new. I've got name credibility, all that. Also, Andrew, if he went to prison, I mean, he might as well. He is also in such a great position. He can come right out. He's got job security. His mum will hook him up with whatever business she's brought up from the ground.
Yeah. Orson didn't have that blessing straight away. Orson had to essentially work to be a part of Bree's company when he came back and was struggling to find a job.
Yeah. Andrew has job security. He's got more going into prison than anyone else on the entire planet other than billionaires.
But surely Bree would also go to prison.
Maybe. But I guess that depends if Andrew would mention Bree.
That's true. And what Andrew, that is true. What Andrew could say is, oh, it was my dad. My dad knew everything. I told him.
Yeah.
And he's dead. No, so I do agree that it is, to a certain extent, hypocritical of Bree. I feel for Bree because I do understand what she's saying when she's saying that it's her son.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a parent, you will do anything to protect your child.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen that with Bree, even in all of the differences that she had with Andrew and Danielle, she has done everything she can to protect them. So I do think that Orson is overdramatic in this scene about it. Orson,
he's being overdramatic.
He's being a bit overdramatic.
Yeah. I agree with what you've said, but also I'm kind of on Orson's side because I would feel bitter about it if it were me, and I wouldn't be able to live with someone and grow that resentment. It wouldn't be fair.
No, I...
And we've already seen what Orson's like if he gets resentment growing in him, so I think it's for the best.
Yeah, I would be bitter too, yeah. And I would be royally annoyed. I would be really pissed off. I wouldn't be able to hide it.
Orson's had a great comeback with his character, but breaking up with Bree here is the best thing to do so that we don't get evil Orson again.
It is, and also kind of bored of Orson.
Yeah, we don't want to see Dark Orson again. Dawson.
But yeah, that is Bree's storyline. Let's move on to Susan. Susan and Mike are having a garage sale to try to get rid of some stuff that won't fit in their tiny apartment and also get some more money because apparently Lee has now found a renter for the house. That was just kind of peppered into that scene. Lee's found a renter. Oh, yay.
Oh, I love a yard sale.
Karen tries to be nice and overpay $100 for this T-Rex toy that Roy thinks is very nice and his grandson would love. Mrs. Kinski, on the other hand, takes the opposite approach to the yard sale game and tries to haggle and underpay Susan for a dining room set. Now, this is what I found insulting.
Yeah, nasty, nasty neighbor Kinski coming back over. Yeah. She's come out from under her bridge, the sewage bridge troll. Oh my gosh.
We haven't had enough of Kinski.
She's horrible, but she's so entertaining.
She's so fun. Maybe we find her so entertaining because we've only had a little bit of her. If she was in it consistently, we'd probably be like, oh, shut up now. Susan reverts to bad cop and threatens to kick Mrs. Kinski's ass if she doesn't back off. And so that's when she's like, okay, fine, 300, which is the amount that Susan originally said to Kinski.
I'm really enjoying this new Susan, now that she's experienced a little bit of the bad bully.
Yeah, now she's kind of got taste for it. She just kind of dips into it every now and again.
She's waiting for people to wrong her.
Yeah. Susan is counting her coins when MJ comes along wondering where his toy is, the T-Rex, but they said they sold it to Karen and Roy because apparently it was in the sell pile, which MJ has no idea what that even is.
Awkward.
He wants it back. Mike tells him that it's gone, but Susan refuses to have MJ go without something he wants and is now on a mission to get it back.
Oh my god, the face he pulls at Mike when Susan says they can get it back. The evils to Mike.
Yeah.
Mum's in the right.
Right. He like looks at his dad and he's like, step it up, dad, what are you doing?
Right. Well, we've kind of all been there. Sometimes my mum would say no to stuff, so I'd go and ask my dad and he'd say yes.
For fuck's sake. We move over to Roy's and they explain the situation, but Roy tells them that he's already given it to his grandson. They go to get it, but he's asleep, and Susan wants to just kind of take it whilst he's asleep and just leave a note and
slip
some cash.
Slip the toy out of his arms. We can leave a note.
Slip the toy out of his arms, we'll leave a note. And cash. Mike, give the guy some cash.
Yeah, Susan's hilarious in this scene.
And even Roy judges this, by the way, when Susan's like, just leave a note and some cash. And Roy's like, a note? Even, you know, you've sunk very low if you've got someone like Roy that's judging your decisions.
And then he turns out to be deaf.
So Roy wakes up the child and tries to take the toy, but apparently he's deaf. What plays out after this is what I'm going to assume is some terrible sign language from Roy. I don't really know sign language, and it might be that it looks terrible because of the camera work. And it kind of just looks like hands flailing about. So I don't know if this was real sign language or not.
Well, he's old. He might have arthritis and struggled to do it.
Maybe. At the moment, we don't know if they got the toy back or not. Mike just wants to end it, and Susan wants to see how it all plays out. And that's where the scene ends. So that was a funny little scene. Poor kid. So it doesn't take long for us to find out what happens. Susan and Mike come back to MJ and apologise because they couldn't get his toy back. MJ complains that it isn't fair, and then Susan chooses now to tell MJ that life sucks and it isn't always fair.
She's projecting.
It's a bit of an adult story to tell a young child, but needs must, I guess. MJ's like, but it's mine, it's not fair. And Susan's like, well, do you know what, MJ? Life isn't fair.
Sometimes you're dealt a shitty hand. Yeah, she's projecting.
She is projecting, and you can see it on Mike's face all throughout this episode and season story so far. Mike's tried to be, like, chipper and kind of see the bright side of things, and Susan's not having it. Like, when Mike tells Susan in the first scene that they found, or Lee's potentially found a buyer, Susan's, like, sarcastic with her excitement and, like, her, yay, stranger living in my house. And then in one of the next scenes, Mike comes over and he's like, oh, lady, you're going to need to get off that chair before the movies come in. And Susan's like, oh, yeah, haha, whatever.
Yeah, not now, mate.
So,
not now.
Yeah, she's shutting down his attempts at humour with her at every single turn. So this is kind of the culmination of all of that, I think, coming out.
It's like they say in The Office, which has actually stuck with me, though, the line that Pam and Michael have when they're starting Michael Scott Paper Company. And he says, I feel like when there's two people, only one person can freak out at a time. And it was my turn, now it's yours, blah, blah, blah. So, like, Susan is staying calm and, well, not staying calm. Susan's freaking out and Mike is staying calm. Like, only one at a time. You can't both freak out, otherwise nothing gets done.
What happens if you're in a team alone?
We don't make shows about single people. I guess you need to get over it pretty quick.
Oh, God.
Good luck.
She tells MJ that no matter how good you are, life still won't give you your dinosaur back. And then Mike starts his eye rolling. Mike then swoops in to explain things to MJ in a way that a child could appreciate it. And then MJ runs off happy again, leaving Mike and Susan to hash out the grievances. Mike comes in and he's like, in other words, we'll take you to a restaurant that plays and has all these games and you can play as many of the games as you like.
Yeah, pizza and games. Yeah. And also, that face that he pulled earlier at Mike, he now pulls at Susan.
He goes, thanks, Dad. And then pulls the face at Susan to be like, Mom, take a chill pill.
Right. My parents are weird.
She tells Mike that she resents him for creating this mess and forcing her to leave the home where she raised her kids, and then she breaks down, and then Mike hugs her and tells Susan that they'll get their house back.
You know what? That was a really sad moment, but good for her for letting it out before it could brew.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. Like, she was there like, I resent you. I love you. I respect you, but I resent you.
And as we discussed previously, this is a big consequence. This is one of those moments in the show where decisions have real long-term consequences that aren't just carried over for an episode or two. They actually have to leave the home where she's been since season one, raised her daughter, raised MJ.
Since before season one.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. And also, decisions like this don't just affect you and your family, I would like to point out. What we are about to witness in season 7 is a combination of Mike's mistakes.
Yeah.
The ladies are saying goodbye to Susan, but she's decided that it isn't actually that big a deal. She'll still be seeing them at poker and everything. And then Bree asks who's renting it, but all they know is that Lee found a guy.
This is such a weird moment in the episode, though, isn't it? Because Susan's saying goodbye to the ladies and there's so much stuff to talk about in this episode alone. Like, as we're going to discuss, one of them has given away their company. One has witnessed a car blowing up after saving Danny. One of them has called a police on a serial killer whilst giving birth, and her husband has left them. And
that all culminates into this scene that we've got to after stuck it into Susan's, because really it's saying goodbye to Susan. But it all culminates into this scene, and all of the ladies are just kind of there. But they can't say anything because Susan's literally got to jump in the car and go.
Their next poker night is going to be wild.
Right, they're not going to be playing poker.
No.
So in what could be her final moments, all Annette seems to be able to do is think about her children. And we get a cute little montage and see the return of the twins as well as Parker. And she's pleading with Eddie to turn himself in, and she will defend him by claiming that Barbara was horrid and abusive. But then Eddie basically goes, what about the others?
Oh, he just keeps digging the hole further and further.
Sticking his foot in it.
He could have gotten away with everything in the last episode and just ran off.
He could have. Oh, that's what he said, wasn't it? So.
And now Lynette just thinks, it was only your horrible abusive mum. And he's like, no, there's more.
Yeah, I know.
He's like, it's like word vomit.
So Lynette then very quickly finds out that Eddie killed a lot of other women too. And so that defense won't really fly. So Eddie suggests that he drive a pregnant Lynette out to the middle of nowhere and leave her there. But this is where her water breaks.
Yeah. Also, that's a really piss poor idea, mate.
Right? That's an awful idea. It's like, oh, I'll leave you in the middle of nowhere and then I can go. And by the time you get back to civilization, I'll be long gone. It's a brilliant plan. Who will get hurt?
I'll just drop off a pregnant woman in the middle of nowhere.
So Porter wakes his dad up, who was sleeping on the sofa, and apparently he got very drunk last night, and then they noticed that Lynette isn't here, and Tom thinks that she must have stormed out in a mood with him because he probably woke her up, but he was so drunk the night before.
Yeah, this is strange logic, but maybe that happens in their relationship. I don't know.
Right? Because Tom's like, oh, did I wake up your mum? And then one of the twins comes downstairs and is like, oh, I've just seen Lynette. Oh, I've not just seen Lynette. I've just gone into mum's room and she's not there. And it doesn't even look like her bed's been slept in. And then all of a sudden, Tom's like, she must have woke up really early and left without saying anything.
Maybe she just went to go run some errands. I don't know. Either way, they had to make an excuse for Tom not to worry.
How did you get from, it doesn't look like the bed's been slept in, to, oh, she must have slept in it, woke up really early, remade it, made it look like no one slept in it, and left because she's in a mood with me and not said anything?
They needed an excuse for Tom not to be worried and go searching for Lynette.
Yeah.
This wasn't it, honey.
Yeah. Lynette is stuck with Eddie, her contractions have started, and Eddie is trying to give her aspirin.
Is he taking the piss?
Right. He's too scared to take her to the hospital just in case she flaps her gums, but Lynette doesn't really care about him right now, and she wears him down, and they go to leave, but that's when Tom appears looking for Lynette, so Eddie covers Lynette's mouth to keep her quiet and just kind of ignores Tom at the front door, and she's got to shut her mouth all while she's feeling those contractions.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure any woman that's tried to give birth can probably attest to is not really doable. Possibly,
but this is all happening very quickly for Lynette.
I can't imagine that it's possible to not make noise when feeling a contraction.
You'd think, but like I said, this is all happening very quickly, and then the minute that he takes his hand off, she's like, we can't go to the hospital now, it's too late. And I thought, Jesus, how quick is this happening?
Yeah, I know. Another thing that I'm sure women that have gone through pregnancy can attest to is the fact that it would not happen this fast.
Like, she's had so many kids, her body is like a machine.
Right?
It's like, get it out.
This happened so quickly that actually, if Eddie had agreed to take Lynette to the hospital at the time that he was planning on doing it just now, he would have only gotten to the car and yeah. Lynette would have been like, it's too late.
All that would happen is that he'd have to wash that car.
Yeah. So getting no response, Tom kind of walks away yelling to Lynette that he will be at home waiting for her with a bouquet of her favourite flowers.
He probably doesn't even know what that is.
No, probably not.
Are your favourite flowers?
Eddie then offers to take her to the hospital, but this is when Lynette says it's now too late and he will have to deliver the baby. So again, stakes are upped, really randomly and unbelievably, but the stakes are upped.
Yeah.
Lynette is trying to give birth. It's been X amount of time. I'm assuming it's going to be quite a while because it doesn't just go from, oh, I've got to deliver this baby to I'm delivering the baby right now.
Yeah.
It's a long process, childbirth.
For most.
Well, yeah.
Lynette's having a good old quick time of it. She's on The Sims and she's got it fast-forwarded by 3.
This is it. Maybe all you women should start taking aspirin. Might speed up the process a bit.
She didn't have any aspirin. Maybe you should all stop taking aspirin.
From what we know.
Oh, yeah.
So she tells Eddie that he has to look and watch, but he doesn't want to because the beauty of childbirth is disgusting.
Well, yeah.
I don't really blame him. The head starts to come out and it looks like the umbilical cord is wrapped around her neck and the baby is turning blue. So Lynette tells Eddie that he has to hook the cord around the baby's neck with his finger, but he claims he can't do that because it's gross, which I'm not going to lie, I probably feel the same way.
Yeah, but we're not doctors.
No, we're not doctors.
Lynette is having the worst birth.
This is possibly one of the worst births, yes.
Yeah, this might be the most traumatizing birth ever, but maybe this will be the one that makes her think, okay, maybe I should stop having babies.
Yeah, this might be like the catalyst for her now.
Like, what if I get held hostage again when I give birth?
Lynette tells Eddie that he has a chance to save a life. And she begs him, which convinces him, and he does it, and she pushes the baby like the rest of the way out, and then cue the crying, and then she holds the baby and thanks Eddie.
Yeah, like, it's not exactly a redemption, but it's like, you know, it's a start.
It's a start. He's shown compassion, and any murderer that holds a baby is no longer a murderer, right? That's the way this show seems to feel like it's going. Like, here, help me with my baby. Save this life and you will be forgiven for all of the ones that you have taken.
The show is oddly sympathetic towards Eddie to a very extreme degree, I feel.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm sympathetic towards Eddie. He's had a hard life.
But to a degree.
Yeah, yeah.
He's still a murderer.
Exactly.
Who kills people for laughing.
Which is a tall order for a stand-up comedian. I guess that's why nobody died at his show.
That's going to be a lot.
Because nobody was laughing.
God forbid if he was a successful comedian, that'd be a long night.
Yeah. So Eddie goes to leave and asks Lynette if she can just wait a bit before she calls the police so he can have at least a bit of a head start. But before Eddie walks out, Lynette stops him and tells him that she will be his mum now and asks him to listen to her. She wants him to stay and call the police, but Eddie can't because he doesn't want to spend his life in jail. And so then she claims that he already is, no matter where he goes. So Eddie promises that he will be good, but Lynette thinks that nobody will believe that unless he shows them that he can be good, and this is his opportunity to do so. Mm-hmm. So she tells him that she will be so proud of him if he picks up the phone and turns himself in, but he leaves.
That was sweet.
And then he comes straight back in, crying, asking Lynette to call them for him. And then she grabs the phone and hands the baby to Eddie.
Yeah, that was a really sweet scene.
It was a really sweet scene, that final scene. And like, I forgot to write down who the actor was again.
I can't remember.
But bravo. He did so well. He was so good in this show.
Yeah, he did a great job. And all of this because he said, like, my life would have turned out so differently if you were my mom as well. It's just so sad.
It is really sad. And that is the end of Lynette's story. So she gives birth in front of a murderer.
Her adopted murderer son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And finally, we move on to Gabby and Angie's story.
Let's do it.
So, Gabby runs to the hospital to get Nick, as per Angie's note in the previous episode, but she isn't allowed to see him as it's not visiting hours. She tries to bribe the nurse with $2 in the end.
Oh, that nasty golden jacket she's wearing.
Oh, yeah.
She looks like an Aldi's own brand version of a golden barrel.
Oh.
It's not good.
How rude.
But not wrong.
She then moves on to gum, like some 8-year-old at school, or like a year 8 or something, where they're like, oh, do you want 50p for a stick of gum?
Yeah, off. Good times. Capri Sun 150.
But again, that doesn't work. And the nurses then swap.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gabby shoves some gum in her mouth, and then she does her very best Angie impression, and we have a clip.
Hey, you with the ponytail. I gotta see Nick Bolin.
Are you family?
Forget about it. I'm his wife, Angie.
Really? Well, then who's that blonde lady who has been here?
His whore? She was here? Oh, I'm having her whacked.
No, I could be wrong. Maybe I should get my supervisor.
Do I look like I got time for supervisors? I got sauce on the stove, Zitty in the oven, and a mustache that needs to get bleached. Let's go. Come on. Let's go.
Now, I get where they're going with this, but it seemed so offensive.
Oh, the Italian New York accent was just awful. But the thing is, she's so domineering about it that everyone is just falling in line because they're scared of her.
Yeah, it's the stereotypes that Gabby managed to perpetuate in this
I'm going to get her whacked.
30-second clip. He's whore, he's here, oh, I'm getting her whacked. Although, sauce on the stove, Zitty in the oven.
I did appreciate the sauce on the stove and Zitty in the oven. I liked that.
It's all, oh my God, and the gum.
As someone who isn't a white American, she probably understands that she could do an accent from any foreign outside of America place and everyone would just be like, yeah, that's probably correct.
Yeah, no one would really question it. She could do it and they'd just be like, she's not white, it's right.
Right, acting is just confidence.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it is. So this works. Gabby's trick works. And she manages to get to Nick's room. And in an attempt to wake Nick up, she throws water in his face, which again, it works. And she gets Nick up to speed with all she knows, assuming that it's Patrick Logan.
Yeah, if someone threw a cup of water in my face in the hospital, I don't know how I'd respond, but I think Nick took it a lot better than I would.
Well, he's just come out of a coma. He's probably groggy. All he's doing is like, why am I wet? And then Gabby's crumpling up the cup like, beats me. I'm not a nurse.
Yeah, yeah.
So Nick starts to get out of bed and tells Gabby he needs her to drive and help him to save Angie and Danny.
Poor Gabby, she's in an awkward position here. This is not a scenario that one goes through on a day-to-day.
No, but Nick does, like, acknowledge that, and he's like, I'm really sorry, I know I'm putting you in a lot of danger.
Mm.
So Angie has built the bomb, telling Patrick that once he hits the detonator, he has 30 seconds before it blows. But he still isn't satisfied. The guy has some trust issues, understandably, and he tells Angie that she's coming with him to Oregon just in case the bomb is a dud, and if it doesn't go off, he will kill both her and Danny. So Angie decides it's best if she just kind of takes a second look at the bomb.
he springs this on her like it's like a surprise holiday.
Yeah.
Oh, one more thing, we're going to Oregon together.
Woo!
But honestly, that threat to kill his own child, that's pretty sick. Like, this guy's crazy. He is...
Sick as in cool or sick as in gross? Because...
Sick as in psychotic.
Because the way you said it and the way you looked when you said it kind of implied that you meant it was cool. You're like, this is sick.
It's also quite cool, but it's psychotic. We've got two different murderers in this episode, but they're like emotionally complete opposites.
Yeah, they're like polar opposites emotionally. They're on completely different planes. So Patrick goes to put the bomb in the car. It's built now. Angie's taken a second look. She's changed her mind now that she knows that he'll kill her if it doesn't work. So she's fiddled around a little bit, got it to work. And Patrick goes to put the bomb in the car and he lets Angie go and say goodbye to Danny. And while he's alone, he stashes the bomb in the linen cupboard instead. And I'm not sure what you guys in America call it, or around the world, really. But, you know, American and English have different words for different things. So I'm not sure what you guys call it. We call it a linen cupboard. Or a linen closet over in the UK. Yeah. What would you call it?
I don't know. I never thought about it.
To be fair, the UK has so many different dialects.
Just a cupboard.
Yeah, the UK has so many different dialects. Pretty much on a day-to-day basis, I'm saying words and B's like, what the hell is that?
It's a Linny.
Or vice versa.
It's the girls would call it a Linny Cubs.
Yeah, yeah, if you're one of us Huns, we call it a Linny Cubs.
Yeah. Can you grab a beddy sheet from the Linny Cubs, you know?
To anybody that might be using our podcast to learn English...
Which apparently happens, Elmond. I'm so sorry.
Which does happen, apparently, according to some of the messages we've got. Please pay attention to when we say things like Linny Cubs, because that's not English. That's not grammatically correct English.
That one piece of trivia has made me feel so irresponsible. Like, I feel like this is the worst thing I've ever done.
It is, yeah. Meanwhile, Angie is saying goodbye to Danny, who believes Patrick won't ever let her come back. But Angie tells Danny that whatever happens, he has to know that she was out of choices. So essentially, just don't hate her for whatever happens next.
Mm.
It was actually a really nice scene.
Yeah, it was a nice goodbye.
So Gabby and Nick park up on the lane, and Nick plans to sneak around the back and ask Gabby to keep Patrick occupied.
Oh, he looks awful.
He really does. He looks like shit.
Yeah.
I don't know what hospital that Nick's gone to, guys, but don't go to it.
Embarrassing.
Yeah. So Nick, who's still feeling lightheaded, thanks Gabby for helping, and then Gabby explains why she's helping. And it's actually quite a nice little moment with Gabby essentially repeating what she said before, but, you know, still nice. And then all of a sudden the camera pans across back to Nick, and we see that he's basically missed everything that Gabby was saying. She poured her heart and soul out to Nick just then, and he's fallen back unconscious.
Yeah, yeah. Because Gabby can have nice moments, but only half the time does it stay nice. The other half, it has to be comedic.
Yeah. Gabby runs into her own place and calls the hospital to ask them how you wake someone up from a coma. Somewhere between a coma and a nap.
Yeah.
And this is when Susan chooses to turn up and say goodbye, but Gabby doesn't really have time for that shit. So she kind of briefly says goodbye to Susan and closes the door in her face. But the hospital have hung up, so she runs back outside to Susan and tells her that she has to say goodbye to Angie. But what she doesn't tell Susan is that there's a maniac over there, and she needs Susan to create a diversion so she can sneak round back and get inside, which is massively shady of Gabby to do so.
It's very funny, like, just to use Susan as a distraction. But even Susan calls out, she's like, well, me and Angie were never really that close. Why should I go and say goodbye to her?
Well, Susan's like, I don't really think we've had that many conversations, and I have accused her son of murder.
Or attempted murder. Came with a baseball bat.
Yeah, and a car. But, oh well, she walks Susan over to Angie's and then leaves her on the doorstep and runs around the back to climb up the trellis.
That was hilarious.
Meanwhile, inside, Patrick is telling Angie that he'll shoot her in the head if she tries to run. And this is when Susan knocks on the door to say goodbye. And Patrick's ready to pump some bullets into both if this isn't quick enough.
Yeah, he's had enough. Like, how many times have people knocked on the door when he's been here?
Angie says goodbye and then closes the door in Susan's face.
Yeah.
Susan's like, oh, today's my last day, so I just wanted to say goodbye. And then Angie's like... okay, goodbye.
Yeah. I feel kind of bad for Susan because I don't think that she knows what's going down or anything. So that's probably her last interaction with Angie.
That's true. And then Susan's like, don't you want my new address? And she calls through the door.
Well, they weren't that close.
No.
And also, Angie's got a guy behind her with a gun.
It kind of mirrors the Susan one where Susan's got Zach holding a gun to her and Edie comes to the door.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Stick it up my what?
I'm just get out of here. God, you're such a bitch.
So Patrick and Andrew go to the car, and then Gabby gets to Danny and begins to untie him and, like, rip off his tape. In the car, Patrick drives up the road and then stops and confirms the range on the detonator, which Angie says is, like, 200 yards. He goes into a monologue about the heartbreak he felt when she left and how he felt betrayed and wanted to punish her, and he reminds Angie that she's got 30 seconds until the bomb explodes, and he placed the bomb in the house, so if she wants to save their son, she better get a move on.
Oof.
So he presses the detonator, and then Angie runs towards the house with Gabby and Danny inside, and they're struggling to get untied in time for Danny to help his mum. Down the road, Angie stops running, turns to Patrick, waves, and then essentially says that the bomb is in the detonator.
Yeah, from a distance, like, it's in the detonator.
Yeah, I know. And then Patrick does manage to say, you bitch, before he explodes.
Now that was a power play. What a boss.
What, Patrick?
Angie?
Yeah, I know.
What a boss.
Right? It's in the detonator.
Yeah. Oh!
Which is why she knew she might not be coming back, and that's why she said to Danny, you have to know I was out of choices.
Mm.
Because she knew full well that Patrick would place the bomb wherever they were going in Oregon, and in order for her to eradicate Patrick, she may have to sacrifice herself. It was a very, very brave. This woman was very brave.
She also probably thought, if I die too, I don't have to live with the guilt of murdering another person, because we know how she feels about that.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
So that might haunt her a little bit.
Yeah, probably.
But wow, what a turnaround, and not what I expected at all.
No, it was a real gag. So the final scene is, for Gabby and Angie anyway, is at the bus station, and Gabby's given Angie some money to get them started in their new life, whatever that may be. And Angie tells Gabby that she didn't want to come to Wisteria Lane, but Nick said that it would be good, as nobody in suburbia really cares or gets involved, but Gabby clearly proved them wrong. And they hug, and then Gabby leaves, and then Nick and Angie give Danny a ticket to New York, telling him it's time for him to live his own life, and that he can go be with Anna and see his grandma. But they need to lay low, so they can't see him until the FBI essentially stop looking for them, which will probably be never, because you know what the FBI are like a dog with a bone. It took me years to get rid of them.
As you do.
Yeah.
So it's not entirely a happy ending, but it's the best outcome.
It is the best outcome. It's sad for Danny.
It's bittersweet.
It's sad for Danny because he knows he's never going to really be able to see his mum and dad again.
And that must be horrifyingly heartbreaking for Angie and for Nick.
Yeah.
And also quite sad for Gabby, who was just getting a nice relationship started with Angie.
Yeah.
But at least Angie knows that she can form connections with people and with people that you wouldn't expect, which is a nice lesson for everyone. So that's it for the Neighbours of the Season.
That is it for the Neighbours of the Season. They essentially say goodbye and get on their respective buses. Danny to New York and Angie and Nick to...
wherever.
I can't remember. Was it Atlanta?
I don't remember.
I can't remember where they're going, but they go somewhere.
And they go to make room for the next Neighbours of the Season.
Yep. I really love Angie. I was so excited to get to her season. Mm. I thought she added something fresh to the cast. She was fiery and she was kind of down to earth and a bit sort of like green, and she wasn't like the posh suburban
I think
bitches.
They needed to give her some of Edie's traits to fill in a gap, but yeah, also make her her own character.
Mm-hmm. So this episode has one more kind of mini storyline, which sets up the story for season 7. So, we see Teresa Pruitt, mm-hmm. Amanda Thripp, who was a nurse at Fairview Hospital, and she's dying. She's back at the hospital that she worked at for so long, and the girl has a secret that she wants to confess. So she tells the priest that she quit her job out of guilt for what she did, and she wants the priest to tell the powers that be so that they can make it right. But what did she do? We don't know yet. So the priest that was with Teresa then goes to the head of the hospital after she passes with a bit of a secret, which again, we're still not told. And then the head of the hospital is like, I don't mean to criticise, but isn't this sort of shit supposed to be kept secret?
He didn't say it was a confession.
Right.
He said it was a secret.
And finally, the hospital board are now aware of what Teresa did and are trying to figure out the best course of action. I'm guessing he's the head of the hospital anyway, suggests saying nothing as Teresa's dead and then they can just pay off the priest.
That's a terrible and immoral idea.
It is an immoral idea, but he is only a Catholic priest.
It's now, proper business money, isn't it?
It is.
What
if
we just do nothing?
We'll do nothing. We'll pay the people that know off. Make them sign like NDAs or something. We'll pay them off and then that's it. Like, we, Bob's your uncle.
I mean, this is a you could kill the priest.
You really could kill the priest. It is a TV show.
Yeah. Say a steeple fell on him, you know?
Steeple. We still don't know yet what Teresa's done, but all we've got at the moment is pepperings of information. And one of the women in the room basically says it's lawsuit worthy. So we're finding out it's getting worse and worse as time progresses. Oh, and in the opening scene, when Mary Alice is talking about Teresa Pruitt, we do see Teresa as she's being like wheeled down the hospital hallway. We see her with all of the housewives in like respective rooms, you know, helping give birth, looking after husbands, you know, all this sort of stuff. So we see her. We've had confirmation she's interacted with every single one of the characters.
Yeah.
In some way, shape, or form.
And you can't really guess which one she's guilty of doing something wrong with because it shows all of them.
Yeah.
Which is annoying.
So, one of the guys in the room is reading their file and claims he knows one of the families affected by this because they live on Wisteria Lane. So, he is nominated to be the bearer of bad news, which, don't open your mouth, mate.
Yeah.
Why would you open your mouth?
Yeah.
So, this news is that apparently there is someone on Wisteria Lane whose child is not their own.
Yeah.
And then finally, the ending of the episode. So, Susan and Mike are getting into their car and Susan asks Mike to drive away slowly. As they pull away, Susan looks onto the street to see why it's so perfect. And we see Lynette and Tom taking care of Polly, Karen and Roy taking a walk, Bree and Gabby walking towards Gabby's place for them to start discussing, I guess, what Bree has asked Andrew's permission to discuss. Bree tells Gabby that Susan is wrong. She isn't a good person because she's kept a secret from her for years, a secret that could end their friendship, and then they go off to talk, and leaving Susan promising that she would return. At the same time, the new resident has driven past Susan and Mike and parked on Susan's drive because it's her new tenant. Lee is showing the new resident around, telling him that he's just going to love the lane. But Paul has already lived here, and so he knows the area well. And we see Paul Young for the first time since season 3.
What a return. Did anyone expect that?
I don't think anybody expected Paul Young to return.
No, he's meant to be in prison.
People kind of just sort of, I guess, forgot about Paul Young because it's been so many years.
Well, it's weird because he went to prison for a murder that he didn't commit, but to make up for a murder that he did commit that he didn't go to prison for. So it felt like a weird sort of justice, right?
It did feel like a weird sort of justice. And
this is weird.
Paul Young's alive. Felicia is still alive, even though nobody knows Felicia's alive except Paul, who is adamant Felicia is alive because obviously he didn't kill her and has just been framed for her murder. So yeah, I think it's exciting. I think this is a gag. Nobody expected Paul to come back, and I think it was such a smart move for them to bring Paul back.
Yeah, and now some people are going to need to rewatch that season that he was in and just get themselves caught up.
And so that is the final episode of season 6. I guess this is goodbye.
Yeah, that was the end of the season. What a finale. So let's move on to the next part of the episode where Joel's going to give his Gayest and Straightest Moment awards. So what do you have for the Gayest Moment?
So my award for Gayest Moment, I'm going to give it to Patrick. I've given a lot of Gayest Moments to Patrick. I've given a lot of awards to Patrick over the last few episodes, to be fair. But I just can't ignore the fact that he managed to have his final words be, "You bitch."
Yeah, and it's John Barrowman.
Yeah.
You know, you got to do what you got to do.
Any gay guy who doesn't say, "Yeah, my final words in life are going to be, you bitch." any gay guy that doesn't say that is lying.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then what do you have for your Straightest Moment?
My award for Straightest Moment. Giving it to Eddie. This is the Villains Awards.
Yeah, welcome to the villain show. What for?
I've given it to him for freaking out as the woman gives birth.
Yeah.
It gives, like, straight bumbling husband in the delivery room.
Like, this is a pretty desperate situation. He's like, oh no.
He's like, oh no, I can't, it's gross. So those are my awards. So bravo to Patrick and Eddie. And now we move on to best and worst parent for B. So who do you have for the best parent?
So my award for...
best parent of the episode.
I gave this to Angie and Nick for giving Danny the chance to stop running away with them.
True, yeah. They've, like, paid for him to go off. Well, to be fair, they've given him a ticket to New York. They've kept the money that Gabby's given them, and then they're like, here's your ticket to New York. Good luck.
Yeah, bye.
New York's not the easiest place to, you know, make a name for yourself or what have you, so...
No, but he'll be fine. He's got a lot of transferable skills. He'll get a job in no time.
Yeah, and Anna's probably doing really well in her modelling career. Okay, and who do you have for the worst parent of the episode?
My award for...
worst parent of the episode.
I was kind of struggling to think of one this episode, but I gave it to Susan and Mike for selling MJ's T-Rex toy that he loved so much.
I knew you were going to do that. How are you struggling to give one? You have Patrick that's tied up Danny in his room upstairs.
Yeah, but he'd already done that in the previous episode.
Yeah, but you didn't award him for that.
Who did I award it to last week?
I don't think you gave any awards last week.
Yeah, I gave a worst parent, just
oh,
not
you
best
did
parent.
Give it a worst parent, didn't you? Yes.
And I'm pretty sure it was already to Patrick for pretty much the same thing.
Maybe.
I mean, trying to blow him up was a whole new low, but it's just too obvious. So it goes to Susan and Mike for selling MJ's T-Rex toy. They really should have taken a little bit more care in what they were doing.
Yeah, and then not forcing a deaf kid to giving it back, but trying to get a deaf kid to give it back.
Yeah, and then trying to give him the whole life isn't fair spiel.
Yeah.
Come on.
Okay, so those are our rewards.
Yeah, bravo, bravo, fucking bravo, everyone.
Yes, well done.
So that was the end of season 6. That was the finale. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at boyfriendsreview.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com. And our friend Louis does the artwork. You can find him on Instagram at docredmonkdesigns, where he also does commissions. Don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you listen to us on.
Yes.
And now over to Joel with the hate mail.
So shout out to Vicky, who say, "Hey Billy Ray and Joel, just wanted to let you know I came across your podcast while at work. I listen every day now while working with you two in my earphones. I get through a good few episodes a day. I love Desperate Housewives. I've watched it several times over, but love that your podcast tells me things about the show that I never would have noticed before. All the subtle hints, metaphors, and even the little things like the colours they wear, etc. I love the end segment you always do of best and worst outfit and parent. Always makes me giggle. And yes, I love Gabby too. I'm only on to season 2 of your pod, and I'm guessing it only gets better. Loved you adding in the clips and stings so far. Anyway, just had a look at your Instagram. It's nice to finally put a face to a voice. Basically, thank you for getting me through my work days. Keep it up. Going to be gutted when I finish the whole podcast."
Nice. No problemo. And we're not done yet.
No, we're not done. You're only on season two, girl.
By the time you catch up, we'll still have more episodes every week and you won't be able to listen to them all at once.
Yeah, true. You're going to have to start waiting weekly all over again. So we are glad to hear that we're helping you get through your work day. We hope it's not all dreary, miserable work day crap that it usually is for people.
Yeah. Thanks, Vicky.
Yeah.
The next episode is season 7, episode 1, Remember Paul?
Remember Paul.
We will see you then.
All right, guys.
Bye.
Goodbye.